After Alpena, I went to Flippin, a town of about 1,000 in Marion County, which had more miles of unpaved roads than any other in our state. I went to see two young men I wanted to run my campaign there, Jim Red Milligan and Carney Carlton. They put me between them in Red's pickup and took off down one of those dirt roads to Everton, a tiny place in the most remote part of the county, to see Leon Swafford, who owned the only store and whose support was worth a couple of hundred votes. About 10 miles out of town, Red stopped the truck in the middle of nowhere. We were engulfed in dust. He took out a pack of Red Man chewing tobacco, put a wad in his mouth, then handed it to Carney, who followed suit. Then Carney handed it to me and said, "We want to see what you're made of. If you're man enough to chew this tobacco, we'll be for you. If you're not, we'll kick you out and let you walk back to town." I thought about it and said, "Open the damn door." They glared at me for about 5 seconds, then roared with laughter and took off down the road to Swafford's store. We got the votes there and a lot more over the years. If they had measured me by my taste for Red Man, I might still be wandering the back roads of Marion County. A few weeks later, I'd be tested like that again. I was in Clarksville, in the Arkansas River Valley, with my 22-year-old county leader, Ron Taylor, who was from a prominent political family and politically wise well beyond his years. He took me out to the county fair to see the county sheriff, whose support Ron said we had to have to carry the county. We found him at the rodeo grounds holding the reins of a horse. The rodeo was about to begin with a parade of horses marching around the arena. The sheriff handed me the reins and told me to join the parade and I'd be introduced to the crowd. He promised that the horse was well behaved. I was wearing a dark suit and tie and wingtip shoes. I hadn't been on a horse since I was 5, and then only to pose for a picture in a cowboy outfit. I had turned down the chewing tobacco, but I took the reins and mounted the horse. After a lifetime of watching cowboy movies, I thought, how hard could it be? When the opening ceremony started, I rode out into the arena just as if I knew what I was doing. About a quarter of a way around the arena, right after I'd been introduced, the horse stopped and reared up on its hind legs. Miraculously, I didn't fall off. The crowd clapped. I think they believed I'd done it on purpose. The sheriff knew better, but he supported me anyway. I finished my round of the Ozarks in Newton County, one of the most beautiful places in America, home of the Buffalo River, which recently had been named the first river protected by Congress under the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. I stopped first at Pruitt, a small settlement on the Buffalo, to see Hillary Jones. Though he lived in a modest home, he was a road builder and might have been the wealthiest man in the county. His family's Democratic heritage went all the way back to the Civil War and before, and he had the genealogical books to prove it. He was deeply rooted in his land along the river. His family had lost a lot of it in the Depression, and when he came home from World War II, he worked for years to put it all back together again. The Buffalo's designation as a protected river was his worst nightmare. Most landowners along the river were given life tenancies. They couldn't sell the land to anyone but the government in their lifetimes, and when they died, only the government could buy it. Because Hillary's homestead was on the main highway, the government was going to take it by eminent domain in the near future and make it part of the headquarters operation. He and his wife Margaret had 8 children. They wanted the kids to have their land. There was an old cemetery on it, where people born in the 1700s were buried. Whenever anyone died destitute and alone in the county, Hillary paid for the burial in his cemetery. I supported protecting the river, but I thought the government should have let the old homesteaders keep their land under a scenic easement, which would have precluded any development or environmental degradation, but allowed families to pass the land on from generation to generation. When I became president, my experience with the folks on the Buffalo gave me a better understanding than most Democrats of the resentments a lot of Western ranchers had when environmental considerations clashed with what they saw as their prerogatives. Hillary Jones finally lost his fight with the government. It took a lot out of him, but it never killed his passion for politics. He moved into a new house and carried on. He spent a memorable night with Hillary and me in the White House. He almost cried when Hillary took him into the map room to show him the war map FDR was using when he died at Warm Springs, Georgia in 1945. He worshipped FDR. Unlike Beau Forney, he spent the night in the Lincoln bedroom. When he visited us in the White House, I kidded him about sleeping in Lincoln's bed, which Beau Forney had turned down. Hillary said that at least he had slept on the side of the bed that was under Andrew Jackson's picture. From the day I met him until the day I flew home from the White House to speak at his funeral, Hillary Jones was my man in Newton County. He embodied the wild, beautiful spirit of a special place I had loved since I first saw it at 16. The county seat, Jasper, was a town of fewer than 400 people. There were two cafes, one frequented by Republicans, the other by Democrats. The man I wanted to see, Walter Brazel, lived beneath the Democratic cafe which his wife ran. I got there on a Sunday morning and he was still in bed. As I sat in the little living room, he got up and began to put his pants on with the door from the living room to the bedroom open. He wasn't fully awake, slipped, and was rotund enough to literally roll over a couple of times until he was 10 or 15 feet out into the living room. I wanted his support, so I couldn't laugh, but he did. He said he'd once been young, thin, and fast, the starting guard on the Coal Hill High School basketball team, which he had led to the state championship over Little Rock Central High in the 1930s. He had gained all his weight in the years when he was a county bootlegger and never lost it. After a while, he said he'd be for me, maybe just so he could go back to bed. Next, I drove out into the country to see Bill Fowler, who had a farm in Boxley. Bill had served as the Arkansas representative in the Agricultural Soil and Conservation Service in the Johnson administration. As we stood on a hillside with a spectacular view of the mountains, he said he would support me, but he didn't think Hammerschmidt would have enough of Nixon's crap on him to stink by Election Day. He then offered this assessment of the president. I hate to say this about a Republican, but Nixon could have been a wonderful president. He's brilliant, and he's got a sack full of guts. But he's just sorry, and he can't help it. I thought about what he said all the way back to Fayetteville. During the early weeks of the campaign, besides the retail politics, I tried to work through the mechanics. As I've mentioned, Uncle Raymond and Gabe Crawford co-signed a note for $10,000 to get me started, and I began to raise money, at first mostly in the Fayetteville area, then across the district, and eventually throughout the state. Several of my friends from Georgetown, Oxford, and Yale, and the McGovern and Duffy campaigns sent small checks. My largest contributor was my friend Ann Bartley, Governor Winthrop Rockefeller's stepdaughter, who later ran the Arkansas office in Washington, D.C. when I was governor. Eventually, thousands of people gave often $1, $5, or $10 bills as we passed the bucket at rallies. On February 25th, I formally announced my candidacy with my family and a few friends at the Avenel Motel where Mother went for coffee most mornings before work. Uncle Raymond gave me a little house in a good location for the Hot Springs headquarters. Mother, my Park Avenue neighbor Rose Crane, and Bobby Hargraves, a young lawyer whose sister I had worked with in Washington, set up a first-class operation. Rose later moved to Little Rock and joined my administration when I became governor, but Mother kept building the organization and put it to work in future campaigns. The main headquarters was in Fayetteville, where my banker friend George Shelton agreed to be campaign chairman, and F.H. Martin, a young lawyer I played basketball with, signed on as treasurer. I rented an old house on College Avenue, which was kept open mostly by college students and often on weekends by my cousin Roy's 15-year-old daughter, Marie Clinton, alone. We painted big Clinton for Congress signs and put them on both sides of the house. They're still there, having been painted over many times as new enterprises moved in. Today there's one word over the old signs: tattoo. Eventually, my childhood friend Patty Howe opened a headquarters in Fort Smith, and others cropped up around the district as we got closer to the election. By the time I went to Little Rock to file on March 22nd, I had three opponents: State Senator Gene Rainwater, a crew-cut conservative Democrat from Greenwood, just south of Fort Smith; David Stewart, a handsome young lawyer from Danville in Yell County; and Jim Scanlon, the tall, gregarious mayor of Greenland, a few miles south of Fayetteville. I was most worried about Stewart because he was attractive, articulate, and from the Clintons' home county, which I had hoped would go for me. The first big political event of the campaign was on April 6th, the River Valley Rally in Russellville, a college town in the east end of the district. It was an obligatory event, and all the candidates for federal, state, and local office were there, including Senator Fulbright and Governor Bumpers. Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia was the featured speaker. He gave an old-time fire and brimstone speech and entertained the crowd by playing the fiddle. Then the candidate speeches started, with the congressional candidate scheduled to speak last. By the time everyone else had taken 3 to 5 minutes, it was past 10 o'clock. I knew the crowd would be tired and bored by the time we got up, but I took a gamble and chose to speak last. I figured it was my only chance to make an impression. I had worked hard on the speech and had hammered it down to 2 minutes. It was a passionate call for a stronger Congress that would represent ordinary people against the concentration of power in the Republican administration and its allied economic interests. Though I had written the speech out, I gave it from memory and poured my heart into it. Somehow, it struck a responsive chord with the audience, who, though tired after a long evening, found the energy to rise to their feet and cheer. As the crowd walked out, my volunteers gave them copies of the speech. I was off to a good start. When the event was over, Governor Bumpers came up to me. After complimenting me on the speech, he said he knew I had worked for Senator Fulbright and thought he shouldn't be trying to unseat him. Then he stunned me by saying, "In 12 years or so, you may be facing the same decision regarding running against me. If you think it's the right thing to do, go on and run, and remember I told you to do it." Dale Bumpers was one smart cookie. He could have made a handsome living as a psychologist. The next 7 weeks were a blur of rallies, sale barns, pie suppers, money raising, and retail politics. I got a big financial and organizational boost when the AFL-CIO at its meeting in Hot Springs endorsed me. The Arkansas Education Association also endorsed me because of my support for federal aid to education. I spent a lot of time in the counties where I was less well known and that were less well organized than the Ozark Mountain counties: Benton County in the extreme northwest, the counties bordering both sides of the Arkansas River, and the southwest counties in the Ouachita Mountains. In Yell County, my campaign was run by my cousin Mike Cornwell, the local funeral home operator. Since he had buried all the kinfolk there, he knew everyone, and he had an upbeat personality that kept him going in the uphill battle against his neighbor in Danville, David Stewart. There were an amazing number of people who took active roles in the campaign: idealistic young professional and business people, gifted local labor leaders, county and city officials, and diehard Democrats, from high school students to seniors in their 70s and 80s. By primary election day, we had out-organized and outworked the opposition. I got 44% of the vote, with Senator Rainwater barely edging out David Stewart for a spot in the runoff, 26 to 25%. Mayor Scanlon, who had no money but waged a game fight, got the rest. I thought we would win handily in the June 11th runoff unless there was a very small turnout, in which case anything could happen. I didn't want my supporters to take the vote lightly and was alarmed when Will Goggins, the Democratic chairman of Searcy County, announced that all the voting there would be done in the courthouse on the square in Marshall. There was no way people living out in the country would drive 30 or 40 miles over winding roads to vote in just one race. When I called and tried to talk him into opening more polling places, Will laughed and said, "Now, Bill, calm down. If you can't beat Rainwater without a big turnout here, you don't have a chance against Hammerschmidt. I can't afford to open rural polling places when only two or three people will vote. We'll need that money in November. You'll get whatever votes we cast." On June 11th, I won 69-31%, carrying the small turnout in Searcy County 177-10. After the November election, when I called Will to thank him for all his help, he said he wanted to put my mind at rest about something. "I know you think I rigged that runoff vote for you, but I didn't. Actually, you won 177-9. I gave Rainwater another vote because I couldn't stand to see anyone not in double figures." The primary campaign was exhilarating for me. I had thrown myself into one unfamiliar circumstance after another and learned an enormous amount about people, the impact of government on their lives, and how their views of politics are shaped by both their interests and their values. I had also kept up with my teaching schedule. It was hard, but I enjoyed it, and believed I did it pretty well, except for one inexcusable mistake. After I gave exams in the spring, I had to grade them while the campaign was in full swing. I took my admiralty exams in the car with me, grading them as we rode or at night when the campaign work was over. Somehow, in the travel, I lost 5 of them. I was mortified. I offered the students the option of retaking the exam or getting full credit without a specific grade. They all took the credit, but one of them was particularly upset about it, because she was a good student who probably would have made an A, and because she was a good Republican who had worked for Congressman Hammerschmidt. I don't think she ever forgave me for losing the exam or for running against her old boss. I sure thought about it when more than 20 years later, that former student, Federal Judge Susan Weber Wright, became the presiding judge in the Paula Jones case. Susan Weber Wright was plenty smart, and maybe I should have just given her an A. At any rate, for the general election, I took leave without pay from the law school. During the summer, I kept up the hectic pace with breaks for my brother's high school graduation, my 10th high school reunion, and a trip to Washington to see Hillary and meet some of her co-workers on the impeachment inquiry staff. Hillary and all her colleagues were working themselves to a frazzle under John's stern demands to be thorough, fair, and absolutely closed-lipped. I was worried about how exhausted she was. She was thinner than I had ever seen her, so thin her lovely but large head seemed to be too big for her body. Over the weekend, I took her away for some rest and relaxation to the Outer Banks of North Carolina. We had a great time together, and I was beginning to think Hillary might actually join me in Arkansas when the inquiry was finished. Earlier in the year, on a trip to Fayetteville, she had been invited by Dean Davis to interview for a position on the law faculty. She came back a few weeks later, impressed the committee, and was offered a job, so now she could both teach and practice law in Arkansas. The question was whether she would. At the moment, I was more worried about how tired and skinny she was. I went back home to the campaign and a far bigger health problem in my family. On July 4th, I spoke at the Mount Nebo Chicken Fry for the first time since I'd represented Frank Holt there in 1966. Jeff, Mother, and Rose Crane drove up to hear me and helped me work the crowd. I could tell Jeff wasn't feeling well and learned he hadn't been working much. He said it was too hard to stand all day. I suggested he come to Fayetteville and spend a couple of weeks with me, where he could work the phones and give the headquarters some adult supervision. He took me up on the offer and seemed to enjoy it, but when I'd come home from the road at night, I could see he was ill. One night I was shocked to see him kneeling by the bed and stretched across it. He said he couldn't breathe lying down anymore and was trying to find a way to sleep. When he could no longer work a full day at headquarters, he went home. Mother told me his problem had to be a result of his diabetes or the medicine he had been taking for it for years. At the VA hospital in Little Rock, he was diagnosed with cardiomegaly, an enlargement and deterioration of the heart muscle. Apparently, there was no cure for it. Jeff went home and tried to enjoy what was left of his life. A few days later, when I was in Hot Springs campaigning, I met him briefly for coffee. He was on his way to the dog races in West Memphis, dapper as always, decked out in white shirt, pants, and shoes. It was the last time I ever saw him. On August 8th, President Nixon, his presidency doomed by the tapes he had kept of his conversations with aides, announced his intention of resigning the following day. I thought the president's decision was good for our country, but bad for my campaign. Just a couple of days before the announcement, Congressman Hammerschmidt had defended Nixon and criticized the Watergate investigation in a front-page interview in the Arkansas Gazette. My campaign had been gaining momentum, but with the albatross of Nixon lifted from Hammerschmidt's shoulders, you could feel the air go out of it. I got a second wind when Hillary called me a few days later to tell me she was coming to Arkansas. Her friend Sarah Ehrman was driving her. Sarah was more than 20 years older than Hillary and had seen in her the full promise of the new opportunities open to women. She thought Hillary was nuts to be coming to Arkansas after having done such good work and making so many friends in Washington, so she took her own good time getting Hillary to her destination while trying to change her mind every few miles or so. When they finally got to Fayetteville, it was Saturday night. I was at a rally in Bentonville, not far north, so they drove up to meet me. I tried to give a good speech, as much for Hillary and Sarah as for the crowd. After I shook hands, we went back to Fayetteville and our future. 2 days later, Mother called to tell me Jeff had died in his sleep. He was only 48 years old. She was devastated, and so was Roger. Now she had lost three husbands, and he had lost two fathers. I drove home and took care of the funeral arrangements. Jeff had wanted to be cremated, so we had to ship his body off to Texas because Arkansas didn't have a crematorium back then. When Jeff's ashes came back in accordance with his instructions, they were scattered over Lake Hamilton near his favorite fishing dock, while Mother and her friend Marge Mitchell watched. I delivered the eulogy at his funeral. I tried to put into a few words the love he gave to Mother, the fathering guidance he gave to Roger, the friendship and wise counsel he gave to me, the kindness he showed to children and people down on their luck, the dignity with which he bore the pain of his past and his final illness. As Roger said so often in the days after he died, he tried so hard. Whatever he was before he came into our lives, during his 6 short years with us, he was a very good man. We all missed him for a long time. Before Jeff got sick, I knew nothing about diabetes. It subsequently killed my 1974 campaign chairman, George Shelton. It afflicts two children of my friend and former chief of staff, Erskine Bowles, as well as millions of other Americans, with a disproportionate impact on our minority population. When I became president, I learned that diabetes and its complications account for a staggering 25% of all Medicaid costs. That's a big reason why, as president, I supported stem cell research and a diabetes self-care program that the American Diabetes Association called the most important advance in diabetes care since the development of insulin. I did it for Erskine's kids, for George Shelton, and for Jeff, who would have wanted more than anything to spare others his pain and premature end. A few days after the funeral, Mother urged me in her get-up-and-go way to resume campaigning. Politics stops for death, but not for very long. So I went back to work, though I made sure to call and see Mother more often, especially after Roger left for Hendricks College in Conway in the fall. He was so concerned about her, he almost didn't go. Mother and I finally talked him into it. As September arrived, I was still behind in the polls, 59-23%, after 8 months of back-breaking work. Then I got lucky. On September 8th, 5 days before the state Democratic convention in Hot Springs, President Ford granted Richard Nixon an unconditional pardon for all crimes he committed or may have committed while president. The country strongly disagreed. We were back in business. At the state convention, all the attention was focused on my race. Governor Bumpers had defeated Senator Fulbright by a large margin in the primary, and there were no other serious contests on the ballot. I hated seeing Fulbright lose, but it was inevitable. The convention delegates were pumped up, and we added fuel to the fire by packing the Hot Springs Convention Center with hometown friends and extra supporters from all over the district. I gave a barn burner of a speech, articulating what I believed in a way that I hoped would unite the conservative and liberal populist elements in the district. I began by blasting President Ford's pardon of former President Nixon. One of my better lines was, "If President Ford wants to pardon anybody, he ought to pardon the administration's economic advisors." Over the years, I changed my mind about the Nixon pardon. I came to see that the country needed to move on, and I believe President Ford did the right, though unpopular, thing. And I said so when we were together in 2000 to celebrate the 200th anniversary of the White House. But I haven't changed my mind about Republican economic policies. I still believe FDR was right when he said, "We have always known that heedless self-interest was bad morals. We now know that it is bad economics." That has even greater application today than it did in 1974. We left Hot Springs on a roll. With 7 weeks to go, we had a chance, but a lot of work to do. Our headquarters operation was getting better and better. My best young volunteers were getting to be experienced pros. They got some very good suggestions from the person the Democratic Party sent down to help us. His name was Jody Powell, and his boss, Governor Jimmy Carter of Georgia, had assumed a leading role in helping Democrats win in 1974. A couple of years later, when Jimmy Carter ran for president, a lot of us remembered and were grateful. When Hillary came down, she helped too, as did her father and her younger brother Tony, who put up signs all over North Arkansas and told the Republican retirees from the Midwest that the Rodhams were Midwest Republicans, but that I was all right. Several of my law students proved to be dependable drivers. When I needed them during my congressional campaign, there were a couple of airplanes I could borrow to fly around in. One of my pilots, 67-year-old Jay Smith, wore a patch over one eye and wasn't instrument-rated, but he had been flying in the Ozarks for 40 years. Often when we hit bad weather, he swooped down below the clouds to follow a river valley through the mountains, all the while telling me stories or bragging on Senator Fulbright for knowing Vietnam was a mistake before anyone else did. Steve Smith did a brilliant job of research on issues and Hammerschmidt's voting record. He came up with a series of ingenious pamphlets comparing my positions on issues to his votes on them, and we put out one a week for the last 6 weeks of the campaign. They got good coverage in the local papers, and Steve turned them into effective newspaper ads. For example, the Arkansas River Valley from Clarksville to the Oklahoma border south of Fort Smith was full of coal miners who had worked for decades in the open pit mines that scarred the landscape until federal laws forced the land to be restored. Many of the miners had debilitating black lung disease from all the years of breathing the coal dust and were entitled to benefits from the federal government. The congressman's casework operation helped them get the benefits, but when the Nixon administration wanted to cut back the program, he voted for the cutbacks. Folks in the River Valley didn't know that until Steve Smith and I told them. I also had a number of positive proposals, some of which I advocated for 20 years, including a fairer tax system, a national health insurance program, public funding of presidential elections, a lean and more effective federal bureaucracy, more federal education funding, and creation of a federal Department of Education. It was then still in office in the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. And incentives to promote energy conservation and solar power. thanks largely to financial support from the national labor unions, which my friend and regional AFL-CIO leader Dan Powell pushed hard for, we got enough money to do some television ads. Old Dan Powell was talking about me becoming president when I was still 25 points behind for Congress. All I did was stand in front of a camera and talk. It forced me to think in 28-second segments. After a while, I didn't need a stopwatch to tell me whether I was a second or two long or short. Production costs were low for the ads. The TV ads may have been rudimentary, but our radio ads were great. One memorable ad, produced in Nashville, featured a country singer who sounded just like Arkansas-born Johnny Cash. It opened, "If you're tired of eating beans and greens and forgotten what pork and beefsteak means, there's a man you ought to be listening to." It went on to slam the Nixon administration for financing huge grain sales to the Soviet Union, which drove up the price of food and animal feed, hurting poultry and cattle operations. The song said, "It's time to push Earl Butch, Nixon's agriculture secretary, away from the trough." In between verses came this refrain: "Bill Clinton's ready. He's fed up too. He's a lot like me. He's a lot like you. Bill Clinton's gonna get things done, and we're gonna send him to Washington." I loved that spot. Don Tyson, whose cost of poultry production had soared with the grain sales, and whose brother Randall was working hard for me, made sure I had enough money to run the song to death on rural radio. As we moved closer to election day, the support got stronger, and so did the opposition. I got the endorsement of the Arkansas Gazette, the state's largest newspaper, plus several papers in the district. I began to campaign hard in Fort Smith, where there was strong support from the black community, especially after I joined the local chapter of the NAACP. I found good support all over heavily Republican Benton County. Across the river from Fort Smith, four or five people practically worked themselves to death trying to turn Crawford County for me. I got a great reception in Scott County, south of Fort Smith, at the annual Fox and Wolf Hunters field trial. It was an all-night event out in the country at which men who loved their dogs as much as their kids and took just as good care of them showed the dogs and then cut them loose to chase foxes and bay at the moon while the women kept mountains of food out on picnic tables all through the night. I was even getting some strong support from Harrison, the congressman's hometown, from a few brave souls who weren't afraid to take on the small-town establishment. One of the most exciting rallies of the election occurred one fall afternoon on the White River, not far from the infamous Whitewater property I later invested in but never saw. The Democrats in the area were all stirred up because the Nixon Justice Department was trying to send the Democratic Sheriff of Searcy County, Billy Joe Holder, to jail for income tax evasion. Under our 1876 Constitution, the salaries of the state and local officials have to be approved by a vote of the people. They had last been raised in 1910. County officials made just $5,000 a year. The governor made only $10,000, but at least he had a mansion, and his transportation and food costs were covered. A lot of the local officials were forced to use their expense accounts, which, as I recall, were about $7,000 a year just to live. The Justice Department wanted Sheriff Holder to go to jail for not paying income tax on his personal expenditures from the account. I believe the Holder case was the smallest income tax evasion prosecution ever brought by the federal government, and the Hill people were convinced it was politically motivated. If so, it backfired. After an hour and a half of deliberations, the jury returned a verdict of not guilty. It turned out they voted to acquit right away, then stayed in the jury room more than an hour longer just to make it look right. Billy Joe walked out of the courthouse and drove straight to our rally, where he was greeted like a hero home from war. On the way back to Fayetteville, I stopped in Harrison, where the trial was held, to discuss it with Miss Ruth Wilson, a public accountant who did tax work for lots of Hill people. I told Miss Ruth that I understood she had helped Holder's lawyer my friend F.H. Martin with the jury selection. She said she had. I asked her half-jokingly if she had packed it with Democrats. I'll never forget her reply. No, Bill, I didn't. Actually, there were a fair number of Republicans on that jury. You know, those young men who came down from Washington to prosecute the sheriff were smart fellows, and they looked real good in their expensive suits. But they just didn't know our folks. It's the strangest thing. 9 of those 12 jurors had been audited by the Internal Revenue Service in the last 2 years. I was glad Ruth Wilson and her boys were on my side. After she worked over those Washington lawyers, the Justice Department began to ask prospective jurors in tax cases about their own experiences with the IRS. With about 2 weeks to go, the congressman finally got his campaign in gear. He had seen a poll that said if he didn't, my momentum might carry me to a narrow victory. His people pulled out all the stops. His business friends and the Republicans went to work. Someone began calling all the papers asking for the non-existent photo of me demonstrating against President Nixon at the 1969 Arkansas-Texas game, giving birth to the infamous tree story I mentioned earlier. In Hot Springs, the Chamber of Commerce had a big dinner to thank him for all he had done. Several hundred people showed up, and it received extensive coverage in the local paper. Across the district, Republicans scared business people by charging that if I had so much support from unions, I would be a puppet for organized labor in Congress. In Fort Smith, 6,000 postcards we sent to political supporters identified in our phone canvas were never delivered. Apparently, my labor support didn't extend to postal workers there. The cards were found a few days after the election in the trash outside the main post office. The state branch of the American Medical Association came out strongly for Hammerschmidt, hitting me for my efforts to get doctors in the Springdale area to treat poor people on Medicaid. Hammerschmidt even got federal revenue sharing funds to pave the streets of Gilbert, a small town in Searcy County, a few days before the election. He carried it 38-34, but it was the only township in the county he won. I got an inkling of just how effective his work had been the weekend before the election when I went to a closing rally at the Hot Springs Convention Center. We didn't have as many people there as had attended his dinner a few days before. Our people had worked their hearts out, but they were tired. Still, on election day, I thought we might win. As we gathered in my headquarters to watch the returns, we were nervous but hopeful. We led in the vote count until nearly midnight because the largest and most Republican county, Sebastian, reported late. I carried 12 of the 15 counties with fewer than 8,000 total votes, including every voting box along the Buffalo River in Newton and Searcy counties. But I lost 5 of the 6 biggest counties, suffering narrow defeats of fewer than 500 votes each in Garland County, where I grew up, and Washington County, where I lived, losing Crawford County by 1,100 votes and getting killed in Benton and Sebastian counties, where my combined losses were twice the total margin of victory. We each won one county by about 2-1. He won Sebastian County, the biggest, and I won Perry County, the smallest. It seems ironic now, when rural Americans vote overwhelmingly Republican in national elections, that I began my political career with a profoundly rural base, born of intense personal contact and responsiveness to both their resentments and their real problems. I was on their side, and they knew it. The final total vote was 89,324 to 83,030, about 52-48%. The Democrats had a good night nationally, picking up 49 House seats and 4 seats in the Senate, but we just couldn't overcome Hammerschmidt's enormous popularity and his last-minute push. When the campaign began, his approval rating was 85%. I had whittled it down to 69%, while mine had gone from 0% to 66%. Very good, but not good enough. Everybody said I made a good showing and had a bright future. That was nice to hear, but I'd wanted to win. I was proud of our campaign, and I felt that somehow I had let the steam go out of it in the last few days, and in so doing let down all the people who worked so hard for me and the changes we wanted to make. Maybe if I'd had the money and the sense to run effective television ads on the congressman's voting record, it would have made a difference. Probably not. Nevertheless, in 1974, I saw firsthand in thousands of encounters that middle-class voters would support government activism to solve their problems and those of the poor, but only if the effort was made with due care for their tax dollars and if efforts to increase opportunity were coupled with an insistence on responsibility. After I spent a few days traveling and calling around to thank people, I went into a funk. I spent most of the next 6 weeks at Hillary's house, a nice place near campus. Mostly I just lay on the floor nursing my regrets and trying to figure out how I was going to pay off my campaign debt of over $40,000. My new salary of $16,450 was more than enough to live on and pay off my law school debts, but nowhere near enough to cover the debt from the campaign. Sometime in December, there was a big band dance at the university, which Hillary coaxed me into taking her to. After we danced a few hours, I began to feel better. Still, it would be a good while before I realized the congressman had done me a favor by beating me. If I had won and gone to Washington, I'm sure I never would have been elected president, and I would have missed the 18 great Arkansas years that lay ahead. Chapter 19. In January 1975, I went back to my teaching, the only full year I did it uninterrupted by politics. In the spring term, I taught antitrust and held a seminar in white-collar crime. In summer school, admiralty and federal jurisdiction. In fall, white-collar crime again and constitutional law. In constitutional law, I spent 2 full weeks on Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision that gave women a constitutional privacy right to an abortion in the first 2 trimesters of pregnancy, the approximate amount of time it takes a fetus to become viable, that is, able to live outside the mother's womb. After viability, the court ruled the state could protect the child's interest in being born against the mother's decision not to have it, unless her life or health would be threatened by continued pregnancy or childbirth. Some of my students, who saw constitutional law as just another course in which they had to memorize the rule of law in each case, couldn't understand why I spent so much time on Roe. It was easy to remember the 3-trimester rule and the reasoning behind it. I made them delve deeper, because I thought then and still believe that Roe v. Wade is the most difficult of all judicial decisions. Whatever they decided, the court had to play God. Everyone knows life begins biologically at conception. No one knows when biology turns into humanity or, for the religious, when the soul enters the body. Most abortions that don't involve the life or health of the mother are chosen by scared young women and girls who don't know what else to do. Most people who are pro-choice understand that abortions terminate potential life and believe that they should be legal, safe, and rare, and that we should support young mothers who decide to complete their pregnancies, as most of them do. Most ardent pro-lifers are all for prosecuting doctors, but grow less certain when their argument that an abortion is a crime is carried to its logical conclusion, prosecuting the mother for murder. Even the fanatics who bomb abortion clinics don't target the women who keep them in business. Also, as we've learned first with prohibition and later with our drug laws, which have more support than a total ban on abortion does, it's hard to apply the criminal law to acts that a substantial portion of the citizenry doesn't believe should be labeled crimes. I thought then and still believe that the court reached the right conclusion, though, as so often happens in American politics, its action sparked a powerful reaction, the growth of an active, effective national anti-abortion movement, which over time drastically reduced the practical availability of abortions in many places and drove large numbers of voters into the new right wing of the Republican Party. Regardless of what opinion polls show about voters' positions on abortion, our national ambivalence about it means that its impact on elections depends on which side feels more threatened. For most of the last 30 years, for example, during which a woman's right to choose has been secure, pro-choice voters have felt free to vote for or against candidates on other issues, while for anti-abortion voters, the other issues often didn't matter. 1992 was an exception. The highly publicized Court of Appeals decision in the Webster case, narrowing the right to choose, combined with the prospect of Supreme Court vacancies in the near future, threatened and galvanized the pro-choice voters, so I and other pro-choice candidates weren't hurt by our position that year. After I was elected, with the right to choose secure again, pro-choice suburbanites again felt free to vote for anti-abortion Republicans for other reasons, while pro-life Democrats and independents who approved of my record on economic and other social issues nevertheless often felt compelled to support pro-life candidates who were almost always conservative Republicans. In 1975, I didn't know or care much about the politics of abortion.
End of Disc 10. Disc 11.
In 1975, I didn't know or care much about the politics of abortion. I was interested in the Supreme Court's Herculean effort to reconcile conflicting convictions about law, morality, and life. In my opinion, they did about the best they could do, lacking access to the mind of God. Whether my students agreed with me or not, I wanted them to think hard about it. In the fall, I got a new teaching assignment. I was asked to come down to the university's Little Rock campus once a week to teach a night seminar in law and society to students who work during the day in law enforcement. I was eager to do it and enjoyed my interaction with people who seemed genuinely interested in how their work in police departments and sheriff's offices fit into the fabric of both the Constitution and citizens' daily lives. Besides teaching, I kept my hand in politics and did some interesting legal work. I was appointed to head a state Democratic Party committee on affirmative action. It was designed to assure increased participation by women and minorities in party affairs without falling into the trap of the McGovern rules, which gave us delegates to the National Convention who were representative of every demographic group but often hadn't ever really worked for the party and couldn't get any votes. The assignment gave me a chance to travel the state meeting Democrats, both black and white, who cared about the issue. The other thing that kept me politically active was the necessity to pay off my campaign debt. I finally did it in much the way we financed the campaign, with lots of small-dollar events and with the help of some generous large givers. I got my first $250 from Jack Yates, a fine lawyer in Ozark, who, along with his partner Lonnie Turner, had worked hard for me in the election. Jack gave me the check within 2 weeks after the election. At the time, I wasn't sure where my next dollar was coming from, and I never forgot it. Sadly, a couple of months after he helped me, Jack Yates died of a heart attack. After the funeral, Lonnie Turner asked me if I would take over Jack's black lung cases. The Nixon administration had promulgated new rules, making it harder to get benefits and requiring the cases of people already receiving them to be reviewed. In many cases, the benefits were being revoked. I began to drive down to the Ozarks once or twice a week to review the files and interview the old miners, with the understanding that any pay I got would come from fees from the cases I won. Lonnie knew I cared a lot about the issue and was familiar with how the program worked. It's true that when the black lung program was first implemented, the evaluations were too lax, and some people did get benefits who didn't need them. But as so often happens with government programs, the attempt to correct the problem went too far in the other direction. Even before I took over Jack Yates's cases, I had agreed to try to help another man in his fight for black lung benefits. Jack Burns Sr., from a small town south of Fort Smith, was the father of the administrator of Ouachita Hospital in Hot Springs, where Mother worked. He was about 5 feet 4 inches tall and couldn't have weighed much more than 100 pounds. Jack was an old-fashioned man of quiet dignity who was severely damaged by black lung. He was entitled to the benefits, and he and his wife badly needed them to help pay their bills. In the months we worked together, I came to respect both his patience and his determination. When we won his case, I was almost as happy as he was. I think there were more than 100 cases like Jack Burns's in the stack of files Lonnie Turner gave me. I enjoyed going down to Ozark from Fayetteville over the winding road known as the Pig Trail to work on them. The cases were heard first by an administrative law judge, Jerry Thomason, who was a fair-minded Republican. They could then be appealed to the federal judge in Fort Smith, Paul X. Williams, who was a sympathetic Democrat. So was his longtime clerk, Elsa Jane Trimble Roy, who was a great help to me. I was elated when President Carter appointed her Arkansas's first female federal judge. While I continued my teaching, politics, and law work, Hillary was settling into life in Fayetteville. I could tell she really liked being there, maybe even enough to stay. She taught criminal law and trial advocacy, and oversaw both the legal aid clinic and the students who did work for prison inmates. Some of the crusty old lawyers and judges and a few of the students didn't know what to make of her at first, but eventually she won them over. Because there is a constitutional right to a lawyer in a criminal case, our judges assign local lawyers to represent poor defendants, and since poor criminal defendants almost never paid, the bar wanted Hillary's clinic to handle their cases. In its first year, it served more than 300 clients and became an established institution at the law school. In the process, Hillary earned the respect of our legal community, helped a lot of folks who needed it, and established the record that a few years later led President Carter to appoint her to the board of directors of the National Legal Services Corporation. Jimmy Carter was our featured speaker on Law Day near the end of the spring term. It was clear that he was running for president. Hillary and I spoke with him briefly, and he invited us to continue the conversation down in Little Rock, where he had another engagement. Our talk confirmed my sense that he had a good chance to be elected. After Watergate and all the country's economic problems, a successful Southern governor who wasn't involved in Washington's politics and could appeal to people the Democrats had lost in 1968 and 1972 seemed like a breath of fresh air. 6 months earlier, I had gone to Dale Bumpers and urged him to run, saying, "In 1976, someone like you is going to be elected. It might as well be you." He seemed interested, but said it was out of the question. He had just been elected to the Senate, and Arkansas voters wouldn't support him if he immediately started running for president. He was probably right, but he would have been a terrific candidate and a very good president. Besides our work and normal social life with friends, Hillary and I had a few adventures in and around Fayetteville. One night we drove south down Highway 71 to Alma to hear Dolly Parton sing. I was a big Dolly Parton fan, and she was, you might say, in particularly good form that night. But the most enduring impact of the evening was that it was my first exposure to the people who brought her to Alma, Tony and Susan Alamo. At the time, the Alamos sold fancy performance outfits in Nashville to many of the biggest country music stars. That's not all they did. Tony, who looked like Roy Orbison on speed, had been a promoter of rock and roll concerts back in California when he met Susan, who had grown up near Alma and had moved out west and become a television evangelist. They teamed up, and he promoted her as he had his rock and rollers. Susan had white blonde hair and often wore floor-length white dresses to preach on TV. She was pretty good at it, and he was great at marketing her. They built a small empire, including a large farming operation, manned by devoted young followers, as transfixed by them as the young acolytes of Reverend Sun Myung Moon were by their leader. When Susan got cancer, she wanted to come home to Arkansas. They bought a big house in Dyer, her hometown, opened the place in Alma where Dolly Parton sang, as well as a smaller version of their Nashville Country Outfit store just across the road, and had a big truckload of food from their California farm delivered each week to feed them and their Arkansas contingent of young laborers. Susan got on TV at home and enjoyed some success until she finally succumbed to her illness. When she died, Tony announced that God had told him he was going to raise her from the dead someday, and he put her body in a glass box in their home to await the blessed day. He tried to keep their empire going with the promise of Susan's return, but a promoter is lost without his product. Things went downhill. When I was governor, he got into a big fight with the government over taxes and staged a brief, nonviolent standoff of sorts around his house. A couple of years later, he got involved with a younger woman. Lo and behold, God spoke to him again and told him Susan wasn't coming back after all. So he took her out of the glass box and buried her. In the summer, I taught both semesters of summer school to earn some extra money and had a good time hanging around Fayetteville with Hillary and our friends. One day, I drove her to the airport for a trip back east. As we were driving down California Drive, we passed a beautiful little jagged brick house set back on a rise with a stone wall bracing up the front yard. There was a for sale sign in the yard. She remarked on how pretty the place was. After I dropped her off, I checked the house out. It was a one-story structure of about 1,100 square feet with a bedroom, a bathroom, a kitchen with breakfast room attached, a small dining room, and a gorgeous living room that had a beamed ceiling half again as high as the others in the house, a good-looking offset fireplace, and a big bay window. There was also a large screened-in porch that could double as a guest bedroom most of the year. The house had no air conditioning, but the big attic fan did a good job. The price was $20,500. I bought the house with a $3,000 down payment, big enough to get the monthly mortgage payments down to $174. I moved what little furniture I had into my new house and bought enough other things so that the place wasn't totally bare. When Hillary came back from her trip, I said, "Remember that little house you like so much? I bought it. You have to marry me now because I can't live there alone." I took her to see the house. It still needed a lot of work, but my rash move did the trick. Although she had never told me she was prepared to stay in Arkansas, she finally said yes. On October 11, 1975, we were married in the big living room of the little house at 930 California Drive, which had been replastered under the watchful eye of Miriam Bassett, a fine decorator who knew our budget was limited. For example, she helped us pick out bright yellow wallpaper for the breakfast room, but we put it on ourselves, an experience that reaffirmed my limitations as a manual laborer. Hillary wore an old-fashioned Victorian lace dress that I loved, and the Reverend Vic Nixon married us in the presence of Hillary's parents and brothers, mother, Roger, who served as best man, and a few close friends. Hillary's closest friend from Park Ridge, Betsy Johnson Ebling, and her husband Tom, her Wellesley classmate Joanna Branson, my young cousin Marie Clinton, my campaign treasurer F.H. Martin and his wife Myrna, our best friends from the law faculty, Dick Atkinson and Elizabeth Ozenbaugh, and my childhood friend and tireless campaign worker, Patty Howe. Hugh Rodham never thought he'd be giving his Midwestern Methodist daughter to a Southern Baptist in the Arkansas Ozarks, but he did it. By then, I had been working on him and the rest of the Rodhams for 4 years. I hoped I had won them over. They certainly had captured me. After the ceremony, a couple of hundred of our friends gathered at Morris and Ann Henry's house for a reception, And that evening we danced the night away at Billy Schneider's place in the downtown Motor Inn. At about 4 a.m. after Hillary and I had gone to bed, I got a call from my younger brother-in-law, Tony, who was at the Washington County Jail. While he was driving one of the guests home after the party, he was pulled over by a state trooper, not because he was speeding or weaving on the road, but because his tipsy rider was dangling her feet out of the car's back window. After he stopped Tony, the deputy could see that he had been drinking, so he hauled him in. When I got down to jail to bail him out, Tony was shivering. The jailer told me that our sheriff, Herb Marshall, a Republican whom I liked, kept the jail real cold at night to keep the drunks from throwing up. As we were leaving, Tony asked me if I would get another man released who was in town making a movie with Peter Fonda. I did. He was shaking worse than Tony, so badly that when he got in his car to drive away, he rammed right into Hillary's little yellow Fiat. Even though I bailed him out, the guy never paid me for the cost of the car repair. On the other hand, at least he didn't leave his dinner on the floor of the county jail. So ended my first night as a married man. For the longest time, I'd never thought I'd get married. Now that I was, it felt right, but I wasn't sure where it would lead us. Probably more has been written or said about our marriage than any other in America. I've always been amazed at the people who felt free to analyze, criticize, and pontificate about it. After being married for nearly 30 years and observing my friends' experiences with separations, reconciliations, and divorces, I've learned that marriage, with all its magic and misery, its contentments and disappointments, remains a mystery, not easy for those in it to understand, and largely inaccessible to outsiders. On October 11, 1975, I didn't know any of that. All I knew then was that I loved Hillary, the life, work, and friends we now had in common, and the promise of what we could do together. I was proud of her, too, and thrilled to be in a relationship that might not ever be perfect, but would certainly never be boring. After our sleepless wedding night, we went back to work. We were in the middle of a school term, and I had black lung hearings to attend. 2 months later, we finally had a honeymoon in Acapulco, an unusual one with Hillary's whole family and the girlfriend of one of her brothers along. We all spent a week together in a beautiful penthouse suite, walking on the beach, enjoying the restaurants. I know it was different, but we had a great time. I adored Hillary's mother, Dorothy, and enjoyed spending time with her father and brothers, playing pinochle and swapping stories. Like me, they were storytellers, and all of them could spin a good yarn. I read one book in Acapulco, Ernest Becker's The Denial of Death. Heavy reading for a honeymoon, but I was only a year older than my father was when he died, and I had just taken a big step. It seemed like a good time to keep exploring the meaning of life. According to Becker, as we grow up, at some point we become aware of death, then the fact that people we know and love die, then the fact that someday we too will die. Most of us do what we can to avoid it. Meanwhile, in ways we understand only dimly, if at all, we embrace identities and the illusion of self-sufficiency. We pursue activities, both positive and negative, that we hope will lift us beyond the chains of ordinary existence and perhaps endure after we are gone. All this we do in a desperate push against the certainty that death is our ultimate destiny. Some of us seek power and wealth, others romantic love, sex, or some other indulgence. Some want to be great, others to do good and be good. Whether we succeed or fail, we are still going to die. The only solace, of course, is to believe that since we were created, there must be a creator, one to whom we matter and will in some way return. Where does Becker's analysis leave us? He concludes, "Who knows what form the forward momentum of life will take in the time ahead? The most that any one of us can seem to do is to fashion something an object or ourselves, and drop it into the confusion, make an offering of it, so to speak, to the life force. Ernest Becker died shortly before The Denial of Death was published, but he seemed to have met Immanuel Kant's test of life, how to occupy properly that place in creation that is assigned to man, and how to learn from it what one must be in order to be a man. I've spent a lifetime trying to do that. Becker's book helped convince me it was an effort worth making. In December, I had another political decision to make. Many of my supporters wanted me to run for Congress again. The debt was paid off, and they wanted a rematch. I thought Congressman Hammerschmidt would be harder to beat this time, even if Jimmy Carter won the party's nomination. More important, I had lost my desire to go to Washington. I wanted to stay in Arkansas. And I was getting more interested in state government, thanks in part to the opportunity Attorney General Jim Guy Tucker had given me to write a brief to the U.S. Supreme Court on behalf of our state in an antitrust case involving the setting of interest rates on credit cards. Jim Guy was running for Congress for the seat vacated by the retirement of Wilbur Mills, so the Attorney General's job would be open, and it had a lot of appeal for me. While I was mulling it over, my friend David Edwards, who was working for Citibank, called and asked us to go to Haiti with him. He said he had enough frequent flyer miles built up to pay for our tickets, and he wanted to give us the trip as a wedding present. Barely a week after we returned from Mexico, we were off again. By late 1975, Papa Doc Duvalier had passed from the scene, succeeded by his son, a portly young man whom everybody called Baby Doc. We saw him one day when he drove across the big square from his official residence in Port-au-Prince to lay a wreath at the monument to Haitian independence, a statue of a powerful freed slave blowing on a conch. His security force, the infamous Tantan Makut, were everywhere and intimidating with their sunglasses and machine guns. The Duvaliers had managed to dominate, pillage, and mismanage Haiti until it was the poorest country in our hemisphere. Port-au-Prince was still beautiful in places, but had the feel of faded glory. I remember especially the frayed carpeting and broken pews in the National Cathedral. Despite the politics and poverty, I found the Haitians fascinating. They seemed lively and intelligent. They produced beautiful folk art and captivating music. I marveled at the way so many of them seemed not only to survive, but to enjoy life. I was particularly intrigued by the voodoo religion and culture to which I had some limited exposure in New Orleans and that existed alongside Catholicism in Haiti. The name of the traditional Haitian religion comes from the Fon language of Benin in West Africa, where voodoo originated. It means God or spirit, without the connotations of black magic and witchcraft attached to it in so many movies. Voodoo's central ritual is a dance during which spirits possess believers. On the most interesting day of the trip, I got the chance to observe voodoo in practice. David's Citibank contact in Port-au-Prince offered to take him, Hillary, and me to a nearby village to meet an unusual voodoo priest. Max Beauvoir had spent 15 years outside Haiti, studying at the Sorbonne in Paris and working in New York. He had a beautiful blonde French wife and two bright young daughters. He had been a practicing chemical engineer until his voodoo priest grandfather, on his deathbed, chose Max to succeed him. Max was a believer, and he did it, though it must have proved a challenge for his French wife and westernized kids. We arrived late in the afternoon, an hour or so before the dance ceremony, which Max opened to paying tourists as a way of covering some of the costs of his operation. He explained that in voodoo, God is manifest to humans through spirits that represent forces of light and darkness, good and evil, which are more or less in balance. After Hillary, David, and I finished our brief course in voodoo theology, we were escorted back to an open area and seated with other guests who had come to witness the ceremony, in which spirits are called forth and enter into the bodies of dancing believers. After several minutes of rhythmic dancing to pounding drums, the spirits arrived, seizing a woman and a man. The man proceeded to rub a burning torch all over his body and walk on hot coals without being burned. The woman, in a frenzy, screamed repeatedly, then grabbed a live chicken and bit its head off. Then the spirits left, and those who had been possessed fell to the ground. A few years after I witnessed this extraordinary event, a Harvard University scientist named Wade Davis, in Haiti searching for an explanation of the phenomenon of zombies, or walking dead, also went to see Max Beauvoir. According to his book, The Serpent and the Rainbow, with the help of Max and his daughter, Davis managed to unravel the mystery of zombies, those who apparently die and rise to life again. They are administered a dose of poison by secret societies as punishment for some offense. The poison, tetrodotoxin, is extracted from pufferfish. In proper doses, it can paralyze the body and reduce respiration to such low levels that even the attending doctor believes the person is dead. When the poison wears off, the person wakes up. Similar cases have been reported in Japan, where pufferfish is a delicacy if properly prepared, and deadly if not. I describe my brief foray into the world of voodoo because I've always been fascinated by the way different cultures try to make sense of life, nature, and the virtually universal belief that there is a non-physical spirit force at work in the world that existed before humanity and will be here when we all are long gone. Haitians' understanding of how God is manifest in our lives is very different from that of most Christians, Jews, or Muslims. But their documented experiences certainly prove the old adage that the Lord works in mysterious ways. By the time we got back from Haiti, I had determined to run for Attorney General. I took another leave from teaching at the law school and got to work. I had two opponents in the Democratic primary, George Jernigan, the Secretary of State, and Clarence Cash, who was head of the Consumer Protection Division in Jim Guy Tucker's office. Both were articulate and not much older than I. Jernigan seemed to be the more formidable of the two, with a lot of friends in Governor Pryor's organization, at several county courthouses, and among conservatives across the state. Strangely, no Republicans filed, making it the only time I ever ran without opposition in the general election. I knew I'd have to run the campaign out of Little Rock. Besides being the capital city, it is the center of the state and has both the biggest vote and the largest fundraising potential. I set up headquarters in an old house a couple of blocks from the Capitol building. Raleigh DeRoque, a young banker from Jonesboro, agreed to be my campaign chairman. Steve Smith, who had done such good work in the Congress race, signed on as campaign manager. The office was run by Linda McGee, who did a terrific job on a shoestring budget. We ran the whole campaign on less than $100,000. Somehow Linda kept the place open long hours, paid the bills, and managed the volunteers. I was offered a place to stay by Paul Berry, whom I had met and liked when he ran Senator McClellan's Arkansas office, and who was then a vice president at Union Bank. Apart from everything else, he insisted on my sleeping in his apartment's only bed, even if I got in from the road at 2 or 3 in the morning. Night after night, I'd drag in to find him asleep on the couch in the living room, with a light on in the kitchen where he had left out my favorite snack, peanut butter and carrots. Longtime friends Mac McClarty and Vince Foster helped me break into the Little Rock business and professional communities. I still had good support from labor leaders, though some of it fell off when I refused to sign a petition supporting labor's effort to repeal Arkansas's right-to-work law by putting the question on the November ballot. Right-to-work laws enable people to work in plants with unionized workforces without paying union dues. Back then, the law appealed to my libertarian side. I later learned that Senator McClellan was so impressed by my position that he asked Paul Berry to call his main supporters and tell them he was for me. A few years later, I changed my mind about right to work. It's wrong, I think, for someone to reap the superior salaries, health care, and retirement plans normally found in union plants without making a contribution to the union that secures those benefits. My base in the 3rd District seemed secure. All the folks who had worked for me in 1974 were willing to do it again. I got some extra help from Hillary's brothers, both of whom had moved to Fayetteville and were enrolled at the university. They also added a lot of fun to our lives. One night, Hillary and I went over to their place for dinner and spent the whole evening listening to Hugh regale us with tales of his adventures in Colombia with the Peace Corps. Stories that sounded as if they came straight out of 100 years of solitude, but that he swore were all true. He also made us piña coladas that tasted like fruit juice, but packed quite a punch. After 2 or 3, I was so sleepy that I went outside and climbed into the back of my Chevy El Camino pickup truck, which I had inherited from Jeff Dwyer. The back was covered in astroturf, so I slept like a lamb. Hillary drove me home, and the next day I went back to work. I loved that old truck and drove it until it completely wore out. Out in the state, I found strong support in and around Hope, where I was born, and in the 5 or 6 counties outside the 3rd District where I had relatives. I got off to a good start among blacks in Central, South, and East Arkansas, thanks to former students who were practicing law in those areas. And I had support from Democratic activists who had cheered my race against Hammerschmidt from the sidelines or been involved in the work of my affirmative action committee. Despite all that, there were still gaping holes in the organization. Most of the campaign was an attempt to fill them. As I traveled the state, I had to contend with the rise of a new political force, the Moral Majority, founded by the Reverend Jerry Falwell, a conservative Baptist minister from Virginia, who had a large television following and was using it to build a national organization committed to Christian fundamentalism and right-wing politics. In any part of the state, I might find myself shaking hands with someone who would ask if I was a Christian. When I said yes, I would be asked if I was a born-again Christian. When I said yes, there would be several more questions, apparently supplied by Falwell's organization. Once, when I was campaigning in Conway, about 30 miles east of Little Rock, I was in the county clerk's office where absentee ballots are cast. One of the women who worked there started in on me with the questions. Apparently, I gave the wrong answer to one of them, and before I left the courthouse, she had cost me 4 votes. I didn't know what to do. I wasn't about to answer a question about religion falsely, but I didn't want to keep losing votes. I called Senator Bumpers, a good liberal Methodist, for advice. "Oh, I get that all the time," he said, "but I never let them get past the first question. When they ask me if I'm a Christian, I say, I sure hope so, and I've always tried to be, but I really think that's a question only God can judge." That usually shuts them up.